Sufferings, it's your boy Marty here to introduce this rip of TFTC. It was brought to you by our good friends at River, the best place to buy Bitcoin. River makes it very easy to buy Bitcoin, to sell Bitcoin. If you want to do that, you shouldn't sell it. They actually have a new thing at checkout if you're trying to sell Bitcoin. Michael Saylor comes out and says, are you sure you want to sell Bitcoin right now? Probably shouldn't. You should DCA into Bitcoin. River makes it very easy. You can set it and forget it by daily, weekly, monthly. If you DCA using River, you're not going to pay any fees on those buys. It's the easiest way to gift Bitcoin with River Link. You set an amount of Bitcoin you want to gift somebody. You create a link. You send that to somebody. You text it to them. You email it to them. You DM it to them. They click the link, and then they can sweep the Bitcoin to their River account or a wallet of their choice. It's a beautiful thing. River builds all their infrastructure in-house. They don't depend on third parties. It's the best place to buy Bitcoin. It's where we buy Bitcoin. Go to river.com/TFTC. Sign up today. You'll get $5 worth of Bitcoin. This rip was also brought to you by good friends down the hall, Unchained. Unchained is here to help you eliminate single points of failure in your custody model. Price of Bitcoin's going up. If you talked about owning Bitcoin publicly, you could be subjected to SIM swap attacks. Had a friend had this happen to him recently where he got SIM swapped attack. They went to go drain his exchanges, got past 2FA, all of that. Luckily, they didn't get his Bitcoin because he has his Bitcoin in an Unchained multisig vault, which keeps your keys offline, and they're always in cold storage. So you don't have to worry about somebody SIM swapping you and stealing your Bitcoin. Unchained also has an IRA product. If you have a retirement account and you want to get exposure to Bitcoin, get direct exposure. You don't have to buy the ETFs. You can actually hold the Bitcoin, take it in kind, as one should be able to do. Unchained makes that very easy. Go hit up Unchained's concierge team. Go to unchained.com/consultation. Learn about all their products, the vault, the IRA. They have a trading desk. They have a lending desk. They're doing it the right way. Unchained.com/consultation. Tell them that TFTC sent you. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Zaprite. If you're an individual out there who wants to accept Bitcoin as payment, Zaprite is the best way to do that. Go to zaprite.com/TFTC, set up an account, and Zaprite makes it very easy to connect your own wallets. They're wallet agnostic. You simply enter an XPub, connect your LND node, connect your Strike account, whatever it may be, and Zaprite handles the invoicing side of things. You can send invoices, payment links. They have a WooCommerce integration. So if you're a trucker, a rancher, a farmer, a doctor, a lawyer wants to accept Bitcoin as payment, go to Zaprite, connect your wallets, and start doing so today. The best part about Zaprite is they also accept fiat payments, so you don't have to have individual invoicing for people that pay in Bitcoin and people that pay in fiat. You do it all in one spot. You can connect Stripe, your ACH, and you send one invoice, and they can pay in fiat or Bitcoin. It's beautifully designed. They have they have dashboards, analytics, everything you need to hand over to your bookkeeper or your accountant. So again, go to zaprite.com/TFTC. Use the promo code TFTC at sign out, and you're going to get $40 off their annual subscription fee, which is typically $240. So with the code TFTC, you drop that down to $200. Zaprite.com/TFTC. Last but not least, this rip was brought to you by our good friends at Bitcoin Talent Co. Bull market's here. You may be looking to hire as your runway is extended because you have a bunch of Bitcoin on your corporate treasury. Go to Bitcoin Talent Co. It's a recruiting firm built by Bitcoiners for Bitcoiners. They understand Bitcoin multisig. They understand mining. They understand the Lightning Network, and they're highly competent recruiters. Andy, the co-founder, started Uber, grew their team from 100 to 10,000. He knows what he's doing. He knows how to go find the best talent in tech, design, banking, finance, whatever you need. They're going to understand your needs, and they're going to go get you the best talent to help us build out the Bitcoin standard. BitcoinTalent.co. Tell them the TFTC sent you and enjoy this rip.
Okay.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
So did you guys have a good time last night?
Yeah, dude, we didn't get out of there till like 10 o'clock.
Really? And started at 4?
Yeah, we got there. Well, yeah, we got there at 1:30 and started prepping food. Cooked all day, just served, you know, meatballs, with like 30 pounds of picanha. We did a bunch of top sirloin and bottom sirloin. And by the time it was all over, then we did, you know, we had to have dinner for the boys. So, you know, Jocko, Leif, and all those guys were there. So then it was like, I don't know, another 30 pounds of high-end steaks just to feed those guys, because they did like a 3.5-hour meet and greet with a line around the building. So, you know, got everybody fed, and then they had to bail, and we got, you know, most of the mess cleaned up and back to the hotel about 10:30. It was a long day.
And then here within 10 hours. So let's give the freaks who are listening some context. What was this event, and how did you end up serving beef at this event?
Well, you know, one of these days I'm going to write a book, and it's going to be called Beef as a Currency. Mm-hmm. Because much to, you know, you and the freaks, it's like we need some intangible assets that we can move things around with. And, you know, steak is a really good leverage tool for that. And Leif Babin, who co-wrote Dichotomy of Leadership and Extreme Ownership with Jocko, they just did a grand opening of a new jiu-jitsu school in Dripping Springs. And we saw that they were going to be doing that, and they were flying Jocko in to do a meet and greet. I said, well, man, if you guys are all doing that and you guys are all investors in our company, why don't we come cook steak and just hang out? So it was really awesome. I mean, they had grills ready for us. Like, we basically had to start fire and make a mess and feed some people. And
it's a return to what life should be.
Yeah.
Working out and eating beef.
Yeah. Well, it's the community mindset, right? Whether mm-hmm. it's the Bitcoin community, the ranching community, you know, over the last number of decades, people are so disconnected from agriculture. They think food comes from the grocery store, and they don't realize what it takes to get there. So even at the event yesterday, we had people that are like, so you're the steak guy? I'm like, well, actually, we're cattle ranchers, and we just take it all the way to steak and then share the message of that in a community type way. And, you know, when you're hanging out in a community with the Jockos of the world, it certainly doesn't hurt. So,
yeah, I mean, that's the journey we've been on this show the last 3 years, particularly since I moved to Austin. Is really, there's been an aggressive intersection of the cattle rancher community and the Bitcoin community. I've had many ranchers on the show over the last 3 years, and it's something that I was telling you on the phone on Friday, we've really honed in on, is that there's these tracks of communities running in parallel, whether it's the Bitcoin community, the rancher community, but they have this innate understanding that something's wrong in the mm-hmm. world. Bitcoin with the money, ranchers like you, that there's something wrong with the food and mm-hmm. how it's being produced and distributed to the end consumer.
Yeah.
If you look at the state of America, we're not very healthy right now.
Yeah. I mean, what I would say is, you know, Colorado Craft Beef is our company, and we can do things a little differently than the traditional producer or consumer would see from a steak standpoint. But man, even if you're going to the grocery store and buying beef, that beef is still healthy. I mean, if you go to a grocery store and you shop the outside of the grocery store, you're going to do pretty good. It's mm-hmm. when you go down those center aisles with a bunch of boxed bullshit that you're going to have a little different health respect. And on the beef side, you know, as much as I want to have decentralized food, that is a band-aid we should not rip off out of spite. We need to be careful with how we do that, because the big four, that run 85% of the food industry in this country, in the meat space, if we turn them off tomorrow, we'll have big problems. And that's one of the things we want to do, is engage with the consumers and let them see, you know, to your point, you know, all these different streams run in parallel, but they overlap a lot. And we're trying to get people to understand where it all comes from so that we can make those meaningful changes without causing harm in the process.
No, yeah, it's very similar to Bitcoin. Like, if the banks were to fail tomorrow and everybody's like, all right, we're at a Bitcoin center now, probably would be chaotic and insane and probably not end well at all. But on the beef side, completely agree as well. You can't just change everything every night. It's got to be organic, grassroots.
Yeah. Well, slow over time. I mean, the interesting math, because You know, my background, I think the easy way to describe me is I'm an agriculture nerd. I've worked on three different continents in ag across a lot of different verticals in the seed and grain space down to, I mean, the beer industry and the grain industry and the meat industry, and seeing how all of it interacts and intersects is something that a lot of people haven't seen. And when I go through and I talk about this kind of stuff, what I'm trying to get people to see is the intricacies and the microeconomics that exist within ag and our local food supply. And there's not a one size fits all answer for everybody, because 100 miles from here, you get different rain, you get different weather. 1,000 miles from here, it might as well be on a different planet. And then if you start to intersect that with where feed for cattle comes from and everything else, that's all dependent on what other systems operate in that area that aren't part of the cattle industry, but they support the cattle industry. And unpeeling that onion, you know, to use the private equity term that a buddy of mine taught me a long time ago, he's like, every onion's got layers, you know, and you've got to understand how they all work together. You don't have anything.
Yeah. No, it reminds me, I worked at a fund out of college and we indexed commodity trading advisors. And so I was an analyst and got, I was baptism by fire, like really coming to understand this from a macro point of view. Mm-hmm. Like we were trading wheat, cattle, oil, coffee, cocoa beans, and learning at the young age of 21, like, oh, I have to be on top of whether or not there's a coffee fungus happening in Brazil that would affect coffee prices. And there's, is it raining in Kansas? Is the red wheat going to grow this year? And if not, and then moved down to Texas, we had a big drought. And that was a conversation with the local cattle ranchers here when we first started doing shows with ranchers, was like, it wasn't raining and they were mm-hmm. worried whether or not they were going to be able to feed their cattle off the land or if they're going to buy hay. And
yeah.
It was during COVID. So the supply chains were all fucked up. It's crazy how little events, whether it's weather or supply chain disruptions, can really affect supply and then prices of these markets.
Oh, for sure. Like 3 or 4 years ago, you know, we ranch in eastern Colorado, which sounds really far from Texas, but it's only about 5 hours from the Texas Panhandle. And the Texas Panhandle had a drought. Their hay crop was way down. We didn't know it. We weren't paying attention. Well, the problem is with the way that the seasons work, those guys know that they're going to be short of hay a month before anybody starts harvesting hay where we live. So they drove up, started buying up hay because they knew they needed to move it south. And since they were ahead of the curve, just based on timing, we ended up having to buy hay from like North Dakota because it just chased it all the way north. And it's little things like that, that now your hay prices go from $150 a ton to $270. It's just this little small incremental, you know, doubling of your costs. And that happens ad nauseum across whatever it may be. Like during COVID, you couldn't get steel fence posts mm-hmm. because the foundries were shut down. And somebody's like, well, what do you do about that? I'm like, well, it's not ideal, but at least it's fence posts. You can get along without that. You can't get along without feed for cattle. And just keeping on all of that is very interesting. And that's where I think a lot of the myopic view of the general public on, oh, steak comes from here. I'm like, well, kind of, but 27 other business verticals have to function so that steak can make it to that point.
Mm-hmm. And so what led you to start Colorado Craft Beef?
So my wife is actually a fifth generation rancher. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to marry as a man, it's, you know, marry up and be the ugly one. So I took care of that. And in 2015, we moved back to the family ranch in Colorado. And in that move, we were talking to Kara's dad, who still runs the commercial ranch, actually Colorado Craft Beef. Kara and I bootstrapped. No family money behind it. No family assets behind it. We just put it together and just kept growing. And we were talking to Dave, my father-in-law, and the conversation was about succession planning and where the ranch was going to be in, you know, 30 years. And I'm a bit of a business dork. I understand his model just enough to be dangerous. And at the time I said, Hannah, do you think what you do is sustainable into next generations? And he's very much in the commodity side. He runs a lot of numbers. He does a heck of a job. He's forgot more about the cattle industry than most everybody knows. And he sees the writing on the wall and he told us, he's like, you have to find a different way. It's not for mismanagement or anything. It's just the market is changing. This commodity driven model is rough. And then if you correlate that back to the banking industry, you know, the regulations are tighter. Capital is much tighter. Collateralization is much tighter. So if you make an error, you may not come back from it. And then you get all the banks on the ag side. They cross collateralize everything. Mm-hmm. Oh, you have a cow loan. Perfect. Well, your house is in it and your vehicles and everything. From our business standpoint, we've siloed everything off with LLCs, and even the banks don't like that because now they don't have you, you know, by the short hairs. And we started looking at like the return on capital investment with the commodity side of cattle. And when you're looking at sub 5% on the Roki, that's horrible.
Yeah.
My wife and I both came from corporate sales. I had a stint in private equity, and we said, man, where can we utilize our skill set in a way that pays homage to the four generations before my wife, but also secures the opportunity for further generations to choose to be a part of the ranch because it will be a viable business. And that's where Kraft Beef came from. So we launched the company in 2017. We started shipping beef nationally early 2018. Tripled the year of COVID. That was wild. And we've been growing like crazy. In the summer of 2022, we incorporated our own feed yard. We found a feed yard and then put it under our umbrella. So we are grain finished. I mean, we do a lot of different things that are a little different than the commercial market. And then last summer, in August, we finalized a partnership deal with Jocko, the other co-founders of Jocko Fuel, so Brian and Pete. And then we brought in a bunch of people from their network. So Leif Babin, Dave Burke, Travis Mills, Dr. Sean Baker, the carnivore guy. He's a pal of ours. And we went and we bought the harvest facility that we'd been using for the last 4 years, 5 years. And the guy that owned the harvest facility was a classmate of mine from Colorado State University. And I'm happy to say that he reinvested and stayed on to run the plant. So we formed partnerships and we built this vertically integrated system that we own and operate. And it's going gangbusters. It's been a wild ride.
And so honing in on the business model that your father-in-law seems convinced is going to be rough to continue moving forward, what does that look like? And how are you and Kara bringing a new model to try to make sure that this is economically sustainable into the future?
Yeah. So Dave operates in the commercial market. So he buys calves, weans them, turns them out on grass to get them into a different market. Different time of year means different seasonality, which means different price points for, you know, Christmas demand or things like that. But in that model, you're a price taker. You can hedge, you can put down on the market and manage your risk to a degree. But I don't know if you remember 2021, that cattle harvest facility in Kansas burned down, detonated the market. I mean, prices went through the roof, or prices actually went way down because now demand was slowed because this massive facility is offline. And overnight, you know, what was worth $150 a hundred is now worth 94 cents. It's like, how do you incorporate those kind of swings in a business model? Especially when you're in a position of decreased leverage as a commodity producer, because now you have 100 of your neighbors that are all vying for the same slots. So with Colorado Kraft Beef, what we did is we switched the model from a price taking model to a price making model. So we get to determine our price. Now there's challenges with that, of course, because now you have extra burger or other business opportunities that are more work, but you can increase your capital returns. It's just a matter of putting in the work and optimizing the system without becoming, you know, the system we're trying to fight against, probably similar to the Bitcoin community. Hey, we want to push against central banking, but they did it the way they did it for a reason. And we want to make that model better, but it still has to function. And that's as we're building things out, you know, we're vertically integrated, so we're able to control our costs. And now we have other value add options like the beef sticks we talked about. We actually launched beef bacon on the website last Friday. So we're doing cured short ribs cut into bacon for like breakfast bacon.
Oh yeah.
So you're a little more nimble, you're a little more flexible, but it's also a time investment to make sure you can get those returns. And then you have to be at scale so you can afford to pay people. And you know, just business 101 on repeat every day.
It reminds me of the Bitcoin mining industry, particularly the push towards vertical integration, because that's what we've seen in the mining world, is it's become hyper competitive as the mad dash for Bitcoin mm-hmm. increases as the price goes up. And that's the big trend in mining right now. There's a lot of M&A going on, and it's driving towards this fully vertically integrated model where mm-hmm. as a miner, your biggest input cost is your electricity
right.
and then the computers themselves. But everybody's really focused on getting the lowest electricity cost possible. What you're seeing is miners actually buying energy generation companies, substations, whatever mm-hmm. it may be, doing JV deals with power generators to put their operations behind the meter, and then vertically integrating from there, building their data centers, but building the infrastructure of the transmission lines and the transformers and all of that. And
right.
it's just what necessitates survival yeah. in that market particularly.
Well, it's all scale, right? You know, mm-hmm. what's your lowest production cost? How do you get there? And it sounds very sterile to say it like that, but that's every business ever.
Yeah.
You know, I've told people in my consulting roles before, I'm like, there's two ways to make more money in business. And they're like, oh, there's multiple. I said, no, there's not. You need to decrease costs or increase your price. However you do that is up to you, but there's no other way to do it.
No.
And they were like, it's not that simple. I'm like, it's actually exactly that simple. The problem is people try to overcomplicate it and get lost in the weeds.
Yeah. Yeah. Simple concept, but how do you get there? It's like, yeah, you got to figure out how to run as lean and as efficient as possible.
Yeah.
And
really, yeah. It's a nasty Venn diagram when you start really zooming out for sure.
Yeah.
And then throw in, you know, all the things we have within agriculture to deal with. You know, everything is a plus or minus 20 or 30% yield on weight or efficiency or cost. Well, now throw 20 variables in there and you get a real financial analyst. I have a gentleman that does some work for me and he's a wizard, but he and I were talking one day and we're working on this big financial model for a winery in Oregon. And he goes, dude, it would not take much for this whole thing to be upside down. I said, that's agriculture, dude. Every day. It doesn't matter what part of ag you're in. It doesn't take much for you to be totally upside down. And the hard part within ag especially is from the 70s to, you know, the mid 2010s, the profitability has just been detonated. Because in the mid 70s, for every dollar you put into agriculture, you could get about $1.35 back is the standard math. Today it's $1.14. So then people are like, oh, the older generations aren't optimistic. They're upset. They're very negative. Yeah, they've watched the erosion of their entire profit model for the last 40 years. It's probably pretty tough to be positive about that.
Yeah, it's been cut by more than half.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty rough. And so you get the old way of thinking and you get, you know, the traditional ag mindset, and you see this decrease in profitability over the decades. So, you know, I've talked about this on other shows. If my wife and I had not started Kraft Beef and come from corporate America with a little bit of a war chest and bootstrap this whole thing with family money, I don't think it would have worked. Because how many times could I have gone back to the family and been like, hey, okay, another couple hundred grand. Mm-hmm. No big deal. We only need to do this like three more times, and then maybe we'll get a deal done. It just doesn't work.
Last raise ever.
Yeah.
Big
last raise ever. Never have more untrue words been spoken.
And how much of this uphill battle in terms of just reaching profitability in the cattle ranching sector is driven by like overbearing regulations and just the construction of the regulatory environment and the centralization of the big packers?
The regulatory risk in ag in general is rough, especially when a lot of that regulatory management is done by people that don't know what's really happening. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a talking point and you're like, well, that's about 40% accurate. But if we, you know, drill out the nuances, there's really no silver bullet to any one problem. You know, whether you want to talk pesticides or implants in cattle or whatever, there's really no carte blanche solution. But the regulation side, the biggest risk of that is it's being driven by propaganda and it's being driven by people with an agenda. And that becomes the hardest part, coupled with the fact that a lot of people in agriculture don't want to go have that fight. They're like, man, I want to I want to be in the mountains of Colorado. I want to raise cattle the way I do, or where I'm from in Eastern Oregon. Like, I'm going to grow wheat and I'm going to ship it off. And if you couple that with the decreased economic viability of agriculture, you know, from 35% to 14%, you don't have time now because you have less money for employees. You need to do more of the work yourself. You're self-performing a lot of that work. So even if you want to have the fight, you may not be able to go do it. That's the real hard part. Within the cattle space, from a regulatory environment, we haven't seen a lot because the cattle industry is so disintegrated compared to, you know, the poultry or the pork industry. Those are all vertically integrated, you know, Purdue or Smithfield or Seaboard Pork, you know, they own their entire chain. So they're able to vertically integrate and get really creative. The cattle industry, one of the things that drives me crazy is people to use the term factory farming and then refer to cattle. I'm like, guys, that doesn't exist. Like, most cow-calf operators don't carry their cattle past weaning. They sell the calves because you have to, because it still takes, you know, 15 months. Whereas, and then those cattle, you know, need to live another year to get to finish. There's a long turn time on that. Whereas if you have a chicken born today, 8 weeks from now, it's in a box. Mm-hmm. Much more math turn, faster turn on capital. You're producing a lot faster. Where you see most of the regulations in ag is you get something like the egg issue that happened last year. I don't know if you saw that. Egg prices like shot through the roof in California. That's because back in 2019, I think it was 2019, if I'm misspeaking on that, my apologies. California said, okay, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, this is the new egg regulations. But California is such a huge market that causes a ripple effect through the whole industry. So the entire egg industry has to change over a couple of years to meet these new regs, or they can no longer ship to California. That's usually is what's driving these huge issues. In the cattle industry, it's not quite as prevalent because there's so many different things happening. If you want to buy XYZ label, you can do that and the market will pay you to do it. The hardest part in the cattle industry is there's so many big players that if you're at a smaller scale, your ability to do competitive marketing is pretty tough.
Yeah. I was actually on the way in here. I saw a tweet from Rep Massey about the electronic tagging of cattle that they're trying to push on the industry to are they trying to do to track carbon emissions or something like that?
Yeah, it's another propaganda thing. Yeah. I mean, you know, that it's really interesting. This just came to my attention about 6 months ago because they talk, the general math is, and this is reported by the Meat Export Federation, not me, is that grain finished beef has a 67% lower carbon footprint than grass finished. Again, it's not my data. It's the U.S. Meat Export Federation. So please leave the pitchforks at home. But the other interesting data that I don't think was calculated in that math is somebody just released a white paper not too long ago that it says, well, you know, you're worried about methane emissions from cattle, which, by the way, is cow burps, not cow farts. A lot of people miss that. They said that, well, if you're feeding these cattle grass and they're emitting methane, sure. But if you didn't feed those cattle that same grass, and we had a winter come through and it lays the grass down, and that grass is going to decompose naturally on the top of the soil, it's going to emit the same methane. Yeah. I'm like, man, that is a great way to think about that. Like, there is no change in the methane emission. We're just upcycling product that you and I can't consume and making it into steak, which is arguably the best protein for us. So it's a very interesting space we're in right now with people trying to regulate stuff they don't understand.
And it's insane. I mean, that's another big topic we've been fighting back against for years, which is ESG. It's completely insane.
Yeah.
I don't think these people care about the environment, social justice, or corporate governance at all. I think they just want control. Mm-hmm. To think that, I mean, you just go to a ranch and you look at what the cows are doing, grazing, plots of grass, them moving along, grazing, and you can actually see like the environment becomes greener and more lush over time. And yes, they may be burping methane into the environment, but the cultivation and the stewarding of the land to make sure that it's actually it traps carbon as well, these emissions as well, by producing things that suck in carbon, produce oxygen. It's completely insane.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you look at pictures of our ranch in the summer, it's going to look the same as it did 1,000 years ago with buffalo. I mean, we're in the plains of eastern Colorado. So, you know, Rogan spends quite a bit of time talking about the book Empire of the Summer Moon, the Comanche book. Mm-hmm. Beautiful book. They talk about basically where we live and how the buffalo were all there. Nothing's changed. Like, we're on sand hills. We're on grassland. The only thing that's changed is there's fences now.
Yeah.
And that's what's interesting to me, because there's this big push on regenerative agriculture. And I agree with the concept for sure. Like, you look at Will Harris and what he's done, and you look at that video. I don't know how many times Rogan has put up that video of the water. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've seen it.
Yep.
Hundreds of times, probably. That is undeniable what he has done at his place. And totally agree with it. And I've emailed with Will and, you know, thanked him for being a steward for agriculture. I think he's a great guy. We don't have that same opportunity in Colorado, because we're in sand hills. We seasonally graze from April to when the rain turns off, and we get 11 inches of rain a year. We've been doing it the same forever. The ranch has been there since 1913. And so when people are like, are you regenerative? I'm like, I really don't know how to answer that, because our place has not changed in 100 years. I would say, well, we don't need to be regenerative right now because we didn't degenerate anything. And that's the hard part, is if you say, are you regenerative? You're insinuating that you degenerated it first. Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes that's the case. Sometimes it's not. But it's very interesting to kind of see where the industry drives it, or the labels, or the regulation. All of it is driven by people that, frankly, are well-fed, properly nourished enough that they can fight against the people that are doing it. And it's so frustrating.
No, it is. And it goes back to like the overarching regulation too. It's like, that's a perfect example of information is local, mm-hmm. and you can't have broad brush regulation on a whole industry when somebody who's ranching in Georgia has a completely different environment, different variable inputs, and then somebody ranching in Colorado is mm-hmm. completely different inputs. And to think that you're going to be able to say, hey, you guys are the exact same, we're going to regulate you the exact same, is just asinine.
Sure. Well, and, you know, I will rewind myself briefly. I also think, as agriculturalists, there's a lot of people that just don't want to change. And I've made that regenerative statement about our pasture and things like that. And a buddy of mine, AJ Richards, just put together a direct-to-consumer shipping platform for protein around the country. Just launched it last week. And he's like, hey, man, I know your stance on this, because I was on his podcast. And he's like, I'd love to introduce you to this gentleman out of Mexico. He ranches in the sand hills. He's seen major changes with some different stuff, and he gets like 6 inches of rain a year. Would you be interested in talking to him? I'm like, absolutely. I mean, not to say there's not new data out there and we can go find it. But, you know, to our earlier conversation, I don't want to just rip a Band-Aid off. Like, let's be a little more tactical in how we're going to do this stuff.
Quick break here, freaks. This rip is brought to you by Gradually Then Suddenly, a framework for understanding Bitcoin as money by Parker Lewis. I wrote the foreword to the book. I'm honored to have done so because it's the best 0-to-1 primer if you're looking for a logical explanation of why Bitcoin obsoletes all other money. Buy one for yourself and maybe a few for your friends. Go to thesafehouse.com/gradually. That's thesafehouse.com, safe spelled S-A-I-F, thesafehouse.com/gradually. Use the promo code TFTC for $5 off at checkout. Buy it now, freaks. The price of Bitcoin is going up. You need to understand it. This is the best 0-to-1 primer. Back to the show.
And when you talk about being tactical and how we're going to do this stuff, like, what is the end goal in your mind?
For what?
For Colorado craft beef specifically, but then more broadly, like, what are your thoughts on like the food trends in the U.S. and the trends of heads of cattle?
It seems, yeah.
Latest numbers saying it's the lowest cattle head count since 1970.
For sure. So the plan for Colorado craft beef is, our main mission is to engage with the consumer, not educate. I think a lot of the ag people say, we're going to go educate people. I'm like, that's a tough stick to show up with. People might not take that as well. So we're just trying to engage people with what's going on. But at the end of the day, with Colorado Craft Beef, what we're trying to do is secure a profitable legacy for the family ranch for generations to come. That's the mission. You know, from an ag standpoint, I think what's really interesting, you know, because that the cattle count is way down, but there's other back end pieces of that math that a lot of people don't talk about. So from the since the 70s, on average, for every steer that's harvested, and I don't know how many Bitcoiners know what a steer is, but it's a castrated male cow that's been finished out. The carcass size for the last 40 years has gone up about 5 pounds a year. So while cattle numbers are down, cattle are the biggest they've ever been. So really the math you have to look at is the beef cutout numbers. And I haven't looked at them. I talked to Dr. Miller on Friday.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. Well, I listened to your podcast with him and then sent him a message on IG. And we talked for like 40 minutes on Friday evening. Great guy. Had a great time talking to him, invited him to the ranch and then talked about some of the stuff we're doing from a production standpoint with like DNA and genetic testing, et cetera. And as we talked through a lot of that different stuff, it's just very apparent that it's hard to get a full conversation about the intricacy of a market like the cattle space in a soundbite. Because in that, you know, steers have gone up 5 pounds a year on carcass weight. Heifers have gone up 6. So yes, cattle numbers are lower, but our cutouts on an animal basis is higher than it's been ever.
200 pounds more than it was.
Yeah. Which is going to yield you around 110 pounds of finished meat on every animal. And I mean, fun fact, Marty, how many cattle do we harvest on average per week in the United States?
I have no idea.
600,000 a week. It's a little crazy. That's when everybody's like, oh, we need more people at Colorado Craft Beef. I totally agree. We won't be to five figures probably ever. So where does the rest of that come from? That's tough. That's hard math. And then if you compare our cost of production with our harvest facility to a Cargill or a JBS cost of production for them to break the same animal into boxes, we're about 2x, 2.5x, because we're smaller, we're slower. It's just a scale issue. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that their model is awesome. I'm not saying we have to support them. But I am saying we got to be careful how we start to move the needle so that people don't go hungry.
Yeah. Now that's the JBS Cargill. They've been a big topic of discussion with the ranchers too, like in the big four slaughterhouses, and how do you distribute that?
Yeah.
And I think what Representative Massey is trying to do to make it so that you can spin up packing distributors and I think independent slaughterhouses like within each state is a good move forward.
It's going to be expensive.
Yeah.
And you know, my typical stance on all of this is to consumers, vote with your dollar. Spend your dollar on the process you want to support. Because if Will Harris at White Oak Pastures is selling more beef, he's going to scale up. If I'm selling more beef, I'm going to scale up. If you need to feed your family grocery store ground beef because that's what you can afford, by all means, do that. But we have to be intentional with how we deploy our resources. And when I say resources, it's not just money. It's your time. Where are you trying to learn things? What are you investing in? How are you bettering yourself? And being very intentional with how we as a society start to move the needle. Because I will freely admit, one of our investors, Keegan, he's out of Oregon, a good friend of mine. He's the one that told me you were going to orange pill me on the show. He has been hammering me on Bitcoin since like 2019. Mm. And I'm like, man, I'm kind of singularly focused on the beef company right now. And I told you that on Friday and you were like, yep, you got to put Bitcoin in the stack though. And I'm sure Keegan's going to hear this and be like, dude, I've been telling you like, but there's just only so much time. Right. Mm-hmm. And so where do you invest that? Are you investing it in your team and continuing ed for yourself or family time, you know, hanging out with the kids, making sure they're good humans. That's probably a good investment.
Yeah.
but there's a finite amount of all of those things.
Mm-hmm. Now that's, I was actually had a good friend of mine, Parker, who works out of here in the Commons. He might be here when we walk out of the studio. He came over Saturday and we were telling him about the discussion we had on Friday. And, that's something we're trying to figure out too, is because like when we had that discussion, you're like, I'm invested in cattle. I'm going to think about like, this is the investment I'm putting in. Like, I don't have time to think about Bitcoin as another investment on top of this. And that's what we have to figure out as Bitcoiners, is a way to, again, pitch it. It's like, it's shouldn't be viewed as like another investment. It should be viewed as like an accelerant to your capital stack within your company. And you were telling me you got bombarded by a Bitcoiner yesterday. Mm-hmm. You really didn't understand the nuances of running a business and the fact that you have costs that you have to bear every month. And if you're not insanely profitable, you may not have the luxury to just buy and hold Bitcoin into perpetuity. Mm-hmm. But that's, I mean, and I was telling you on Friday, like we run this company on a Bitcoin standard. We send invoices, we accept Bitcoin for advertisements, but we also have USD expenses. And so that's the way I apply it to this business, is I'll accept Bitcoin as payment. I'll look at my books every month and cash flow and profits and be like, all right, this month I'm going to put X amount into Bitcoin and hold it. And it has the argument for holding Bitcoin on your balance sheet. If you can do it over a 4-year period, it is a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. And that's the question every business owner has to answer, is like, all right, how much Bitcoin can I buy and hold for a 4-year period? Because historically, the price of Bitcoin has gone up significantly over a 4-year period. Nobody's lost money holding Bitcoin for 4 years. And so thinking of like a long-term treasury asset, that's how Bitcoin is viewed. You don't view it as something that you're going to make money on this year, next year. You got to buy and hold it on your treasury for 4 years. What I've just seen at this company is by doing that, I was telling you on Friday, like, it has enabled me to reinvest at particular points in time to really accelerate what we're trying to do here.
Yeah. The weirdest thing that I just knowing, so I do all the financial work for our company. That's, oddly enough, my wife is the cattle manager. She has a master's degree in cow nutrition. Grew up as a fifth generation rancher. I don't need to play in that particular pool. But the interesting thing within ag, especially production agriculture, is the banking is so tight. Like, you have XYZ asset. If you can get 70% loan to value on a collateral basis, you're doing pretty good.
Yeah.
And the number of banks that will lend to agriculture, very strict agriculture, is relatively small. Then you get into a specialty market like what we do, which is pretty hard to collateralize. Like, live cattle have a known value. Well, now we're going to harvest those cattle. They're going to be in a box. Now they have a different cost of inputs, but it's no longer a known value for the bank. So they have to collateralize back against that. That's been one of the biggest challenges we've had as a company as we scale, is because now we're getting out of like traditional banking agriculture. And we're big enough that the capital is kind of scary to them with an unknown market, and it's based on projections. I would be really curious to see what my bank said if I said, okay, now Bitcoin's in this same collateral stack. I don't know that that would go my way.
No, not right now.
No.
But
I think there's a ton of value. Don't get me wrong. But the banks, especially in the ag sector, are so risk averse, especially right now with interest rates being insane. And a lot of ag is just generally unprofitable. I would be shocked if there wasn't a massive amount of pushback.
No, I would be too.
Yeah.
But it's insane because the market's still basically coming to understand Bitcoin. I think in the future, who knows at what point, but I do think at some point in the next decade, Bitcoin as collateral will be preferred to something like a tractor or even land, if you will, just because of the fact of how liquid it is. And it trades 24/7, 365, and you can prove.
Yeah, the market discovery is active all the time, right?
Yeah, and so the company down the hall, Unchained, they're probably the leader in terms of like Bitcoin collateralized lending and the way they've constructed their escrow for the lending product is beautiful because it's in Bitcoin. You can have what's called a multi-sig wallet where you put Bitcoin in this wallet, and to move it, you need two or three signatures from two different key agents in the quorum. And so you can imagine a scenario where you're going to take a loan out as a rancher and you put Bitcoin in this wallet, you hold a key, the bank holds a key, and then a agnostic third party holds a key. Mm-hmm. And the Bitcoin sits in that wallet. The bank can see it. You can see it. That third party can see it. And you know it's there. The collateral's there. And then, God forbid, anything happens to your business and they need to liquidate the collateral, they can sign the transaction. A third party can sign the transaction, move the Bitcoin, you liquidate it. Mm-hmm. It's much, when you think about liquidating collateral in a lending structure, if you were to collateralize like farming tractors or land or whatever it be, and you think about the liquidity profile of those assets, it, like, in the future, it'll be very obvious that Bitcoin's preferable in that collateral stack for
sure.
For these operators.
Are you familiar with like borrowing based structure? Yeah, that's very common in the ag space. Yeah. So, oh, I have a hay pile, you know, 400 tons of hay. It's worth, I don't know, call it 80 grand. Every month you're re-upping those inventory numbers because your inventory is constantly moving, right? We're feeding cattle, but now the cattle are worth more and this has moved down. And it's that constant rebalancing every month. Is kind of the traditional ag lending side, especially on the production side. It's not long-term, it's month to month.
Yeah.
And I would be curious, without knowing much about Bitcoin, is the volatility of that market and if that might invert and you have a real problem because that's that monthly, oh, where do we stand?
Yeah, and that's where, so that's, we're in the nation stages of this collateral market for Bitcoin specifically. So like Unchained's LTV is 40%. Because of the volatility of the Bitcoin.
That's rough.
Price. Yeah.
40% is hard.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't think this problem's solved yet, but I do think over time it will be solved as the Bitcoin market cap increases and becomes more stable. The price volatility decreases.
What's the regulatory side of Bitcoin going to be, though? Because I'm sure the central banks and most governments are kind of against not being part of the global commerce system. So what's the risk on your guys' side with the Bitcoin stuff? You know, with a 40% collateral today, how do we grow that to 70 or 80 that's more of a bankable business model?
I think it comes down to the capital providers on the lending side. So that's like, just because Bitcoin's history up to this point, 15 years in, it's been hyper volatile. You've seen exchanges go down, the FTXs, the BlockFi's, the Celsius, the Mt. Goxes of the world really scared traditional capital from coming in and being comfortable backing a lending desk. And it took a lot of trial and error to realize that there's ways to do it, like the way Unchained does it, where it's essentially, it's nothing's risk-free, but it's as close to risk-free as you can get with this collateral setup, the escrow setup. A bunch of companies in the past were taking people's Bitcoin, lending them dollars, and then they were taking that Bitcoin and lending it out to degenerate traders who were losing the Bitcoin. So all those lending desks went under because they weren't really respecting the nature of Bitcoin as this hard asset and the fact that there's no lender of last resort. Like if you're going to do these lending models, it has to sit in a multi-sig wallet and don't move. You can't rehypothecate it to people. And the market has learned that lesson, and I think we're finally at a point where it's obvious, like, all right, if you're going to lend Bitcoin out, it's got to be done in this way. So I think just from an education and maturation process, we're at that point. And we'll get better where capital providers will get more comfortable putting their dollars up to lend against Bitcoin collateralized loans. And I think the timing is actually really ripe for that because if you look at like private credit markets, they're all looking for yield and it's the treasury markets are fucked. The corporate bond markets are fucked. And when it comes to like a credit product, like where are you going to get yield as the Bitcoin price goes up, Bitcoiners don't want to sell their Bitcoin. They'd rather lend against it. There's going to be a lot of capital that can be made from these credit funds, putting dollars in these products. And that's only one aspect of Bitcoin's value in this particular and from your perspective is yes, it can be good collateral. It's still maturing through that process of Bitcoin as collateral. But then again, like, just from trusted third parties like banks, like the banking system is very woefully systemically fragile right now. Like, if you look at, I retweeted a tweet right before I hopped out of my Uber to come to this interview. The treasury issuance is back at COVID levels, like April 2020 levels.
Wow.
In terms of like debt expansion. So there's definitely a liquidity problem.
Well, a lot of the bigger financial institutions have closed their ag divisions. A lot of the big banks won't play in agriculture because it's too volatile. Yeah. It's very interesting. And that's been happening for the last couple of decades where, you know, big financial institutions are offloading their entire ag portfolio. And it's like, oh, so we have fewer lenders. Mm-hmm. It's rough.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's the fiat system. Like, right. you've printed all this money and you've created these perverse incentives to like seek yield, and which means you got to go take more insane risk and allocate capital in a way that arguably would not be allocated in the same way if we had a sound money standard. It's just literally you have to keep up with the pace of debt issuance and monetary base expansion to try to create a yield on top of that, just to beat inflation year in and year out. And so just capital spread way thin in areas it arguably should not be in. And you create this systemically weak and fragile system. And that's hopefully what Bitcoin's gonna fix, where under sound money standard with Bitcoin, you bring opportunity costs back to the market. And as a capital allocator, you have to think really hard, like, all right, if I put this Bitcoin here, and am I going to get it back? And you get more sound capital allocation strategies. And then on top of that, like, that's just the one aspect, is the sound money aspect. There's only 21 million Bitcoin. You have the scarce asset that's going to appreciate over time and increase the purchasing power of your balance sheet over the long run. But then you have this redundancy track as well. The fact that it runs in this distributed peer-to-peer ledger that allows you to actually custody your money and hold it. And so, like, when you think of like a potential banking crisis, we saw this time last year with Silicon Valley Bank and First Republic and Signature Bank, like, with the fragile state of the banking system. Like, I make a very strong argument that it makes sense to hold Bitcoin just in case the banks go down. Because if the Fed didn't step in, and the FDIC didn't step in for Silicon Valley Bank specifically last year, like, the whole startup space in Silicon Valley was not going to be able to make payroll. And so that's like another argument for holding Bitcoin in the balance sheet is, God forbid, you have a systemic banking crisis again and the banks don't allow you to get access to your money, or you get bailed in. They take a portion of your deposits and bail out the bank.
Yeah, because there's a lot of people that are talking about just don't have cash. Cash is a horrible idea, because what is cash? You know, cash is a number in a bank that may crash tomorrow. And that's why the ag space, I really love what we've done, because not just our company, but ag in general, most of it's in assets. It's in hard assets. You know, I have cows. If the entire banking system falls apart tomorrow, people still need to eat.
Yep.
Or I had a buddy that was in the oil field, and he goes, I almost never have cash. I was like, really? He goes, yeah, I have extra pipe. He'd just buy it. Like, if he had extra cash on the balance sheet, he just bought another load of steel. And he goes, because those are real assets. And he goes, the banking system is garbage.
Yeah.
He's like, I want real assets. And so if Bitcoin, you know, could be that other potential real asset that can move and become a currency that's, you know, air quotes, a harder asset than numbers in a app that may or may not exist tomorrow, I think that'd be a great idea.
Yeah. No, and like, using that example, like, your buddy buying steel, like, that's where like Bitcoin fits in. Again, it's solving the double coincidence of one's problem. It's money. And so, yeah, he's putting it in the steel, but maybe he doesn't need that steel, and he's just using it as a store of value instead of cash. That's where Bitcoin comes in. So, like, instead of buying that steel that you may not need, just buy Bitcoin. Again, it's extremely liquid, trades 24/7, 365. Instead of putting in steel, put it in Bitcoin. And then at some point in the future, when you actually need to buy something, maybe you don't need to buy steel. Maybe you need to buy, maybe you're drilling a well and you need a drill team to frack. And so you need to pay for that team. Like, instead of selling the steel and then using the cash to pay for that team, just either use the Bitcoin or sell the Bitcoin.
Just a different form of savings.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's, and that's why we have Fix the Money, Fix the World out here, because I think like what you just described is whether individuals realize it intuitively or not, they're forced to make these, take these actions, which really don't make sense at the end of the day. Like, you should be able to just save money. You should be able to, like, in a sane world, in a sane economy, you should be able to save cash and build up a cash treasury to basically allocate at some point in the future to invest in your company with the particular needs that exist at that time. But
yeah, are you saying it's not equitable that my bank pays 0.4% on on savings but charges 9.25% right now?
Yeah, no. It's not.
I've always had a problem with that particular discrepancy. I'm like, I know you're re-lending our capital and charging 9%. Like, who's screwing who in this particular environment?
And they're creating money out of thin air in that process.
100%.
Right? That's actually how money is created, is in the commercial banking system when they issue new loans.
Yeah, the money multiplier is, I remember seeing that. So my degree is actually in ag business with minors in accounting and finance. And I remember the first time I was in a college finance class and they showed the money multiplier. And I was like, well, this is how it works. I'm like, that looks like smoke and mirrors, and a balance sheet shouldn't hold up to that math. Yeah. And
well, it's all fugazi. And the really unnerving part right now is the Western governments have weaponized this monetary system internationally, mm-hmm. like with the external to what you think of what's going on in Russia, Ukraine, just honing in on the fact that the Western governments froze and are now liquidating Russia's treasury assets is an insane move on their part, because they've mm-hmm. essentially proven, like, oh, as a sovereign nation, you actually don't control your wealth. Like,
yeah.
It runs on the rails that we control, and so we control it at the end of the day. And there's countries in the Middle East, all over the world, who saw what the West has done to Russia's treasury assets. They're like, holy shit, we cannot hold our assets in treasuries. And like, I don't think there's been many public statements about a move away from this outside of like the BRICS countries saying like, yeah, we need to band up and get away from SWIFT and the dollar system. But you have to imagine that all these countries are thinking we need an alternative to the treasury market and the dollar system, because they can freeze our assets.
Yeah.
If we say something wrong, or if we do something wrong.
There's a book I would recommend, to all the freaks out there. It's called The Coming Jobs War. I don't know if you've read it.
I have not.
It is a terrifying read, but it was written by the gentleman whose dad founded the Gallup polls.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about the five boat anchors on the economy of the U.S. and how the U.S. was almost not a superpower in the 70s. And then we invented the internet. And it comes, since it's from the Gallup polls, it comes with a ton of data. So it's very data driven. Great read. And then, you know, the caveat to that is my wife was at a conference, would have been like 2018, 2017. And I've made this statement and I've gotten a lot of hate because of it, but it's not my statement, but it's an interesting concept. When we discuss food, there was a gentleman that was a global economist, and he's talking about population growth, ability for countries to feed themselves. And there's only three countries in the world at the time that he said 50 years from now would be able to self-sustain their population with food. It was the U.S., Argentina, and New Zealand. And the other caveat was still be able to export, because that's what matters, right? You can grow all the food you want, but if your infrastructure to export that food to other countries is poor, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Like, Brazil grows a ton of food, but they have like two ports. Now, granted, in 50 years, you can build a lot of infrastructure, but the concept was 50 years from now, you know, 2050 or so, based on current population growth and food production, especially with regulatory changes, et cetera, that at some point we were going to start to hit a tipping point where food was going to be weaponized because of countries growing and not being able to support their own population. And then certain countries were going to raise quite a lot in the rankings of global power because of their ability to control food supply. And I watched my wife got the presentation and showed it to me, and I was like, you know, I've had people from Argentina, they're like, there's no way. And I'm like, I'm not saying that's what's going to happen, but it was an interesting thought exercise. You know, when we talk about the food system and what are we weaponizing and what are governments doing, that is not that far of a reach.
No.
It's just right there.
I mean, you can, if you look hard enough, you squint, you look, it seems like they're preparing for this food crisis with the push to eat the bugs and the lab-grown meat. It seems like those are sort of moves foreseeing a food crisis at some point in the future. It's like, hey, they say, it's like, oh no, this is healthier, it's better for the environment. But I see that, and I'm like, they see something on the horizon. They're trying to make it look like eating bugs is actually a good decision, and sort of trick people into doing it so they can.
I'll stick with steak.
Yeah, I will as well. No, you get back, like, another big thing is like the competency crisis. So like taking a step back and thinking of Bitcoin and money from a macro level, like that's a big problem in our world today with inflation where it's at, with taxes where they're at, particularly here in the US. Like, you just have people who are working, millennials specifically, who are told, like, you go to college, you get a degree, you go get a good job, you'll be able to have the life that I had. Mm-hmm. And you'll be able to buy a house, raise a family, do everything you want. And that's just not materializing. And it's really demoralizing.
Oh, man, 30 years ago, a good corporate job was the meal ticket. You were solid. You were going to have a 401k. You were going to have a house and two cars and your wife and two kids. And it was very traditional, you know, 80s, 90s. And now it almost seems like the only surefire way to have a job forever is to work for the government.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I've seen corporations, I know of one that, so pre-COVID, they had around 200 sales employees nationwide. They go into COVID, cut a third of them. They cut around 50 positions, drop the sales team down to 150, give a very generous severance. But overnight, you know, 50 of these people that were in very high level sales positions are gone. That's, you know, early 2020, October of 2022, all hands meeting tomorrow morning, and they cut the sales force from 150 to 50.
Holy shit.
So in a matter of 2.5 years, they took this 200 person sales team down to 50 people, massive swing. Here's the crazy part. I know this move very, very well. I know a lot of the inner workings of what happened. They were still exceeding sales budgets. They were crushing the numbers. All these people were performing. They were doing what was asked of them transactionally, you know, in this employment arrangement. It still didn't matter because somebody looking at a spreadsheet somewhere determined that this is the business move and, you know, those 100 people be damned. And that's the sad part because everybody thinks, oh, corporate will be safe. It'll be this. I'm like, it's never been more volatile. And I could be a little more supportive of that company making that move. It's like, hey, we have to make a pivot. Mm-hmm. Something's not right. But when you're selling 15% above the budget that was set for you and they still axe 2/3 of the group, it's bananas. I don't know how to reconcile some of that, which is, you know, entrepreneurship and decentralized employment and, you know, the human side of society is being lost in a lot of ways.
Oh, it is. And it's really beginning to weigh on people, which is the scary part. Why, like, I feel compelled to work on Bitcoin and like push it into existence and make it not only prevalent to people, but pervasive throughout our economies. Because again, it all comes back to like, as people are making those decisions, because they're looking at spreadsheets, they're not looking at, and because they know that in the future, the government's going to print a bunch of money. We have to keep our cost as low as possible just to beat inflation. And again, it's this perverse incentive that has been injected into our economy with easy money. And that's the concept of Bitcoin mining is like proof of work, and why I think it becomes intuitive to a lot of people that we've talked to in the cattle ranching industry is because your whole business is proof of work, like literally toiling on the land to produce food that people eat. That energizes them as individuals and then go forth and energize the economy. And when you get to that concept of like proof of work, like you do a lot of work, you work hard, you do your job, you expect to get paid in a wage that respects that, and that mm-hmm. can then sustain a life that is respectable. And the money just doesn't do that. Like you do your work and you get paid and something that's literally evaporating in front of you. And you're like forced to go speculate in the stock market, become an expert stock picker just to save your money and save your wealth.
Well, the hard part is, especially in ag, with that decrease in profitability that we've seen over the last few decades, nobody wants to come back. So while there's a ton of people that are railing against operations getting bigger and these huge family operations, those guys are the ones that have done the business work to make it profitable and to continue to thrive in this weird system we're in. And the problem is, to be at scale enough to be profitable requires a lot of input, and a lot of people don't have that. So these small ranches and small farms are getting gobbled up by other bigger family operations. And it's just math.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the guys that used to be able to farm on 600 or 800 acres and make a family living of it in the '70s can't do that anymore. And the problem is, by the time they got to the '90s and their kids were grown and went to college and they saw that after the banking crisis in the '80s and interest rates and commodity prices are low, who wants to come back to that? Because the big argument in agriculture is the way of life and our lifestyle. And this is important. Yeah. And I love that stuff. Don't get me wrong, but I also love feeding my kids. And there has to be an incentive, and you have to be able to do it in a way that has good mental health. You know, there's a big suicide issue in the ag and farming community. Actually with all that hemp stuff that went down during COVID, there's hundreds of farmers that committed suicide over hemp.
Really?
Because, because they went all in and the market detonated and they didn't have a choice. They were done. And they chose that route, which I don't support, but also was in that guy's boots.
Yeah.
I mean, I know, and I think the last I heard, there was like 11 farmers in the Willamette Valley of Oregon that were just done.
Yeah.
And that happens ad nauseum around the country because, I mean, to get back in like the ag banking side, you own, you know, your family gives you the generational farm. And you have $1 million in equity. Well, if you're not profitable, the bank will continue to loan you money. They'll just take more equity until you're done.
Yeah.
And that's the hard part. That's where it's getting really sideways, because the bank doesn't demand profitability because you're sitting on a mountain of equity and they'll just let you work it until it's gone. And that's the system. I don't agree with it. I think we should have an ability to look at somebody and say, hey, what are you doing? But they love the way of life or whatever it may be. And it's hard to watch.
Yeah. And the bank takes the land, flips it to Bill Gates and it's really fucked up. And then you compound it again with the competency crisis, like the incentives of the system, are such where like you have a family farm, you want to pass it down to your kids, but your kids today, they're looking at the economy and they're like, I'm not going to make much money doing this. Like all the money's in Wall Street or big tech, which are being flooded with easy money. And so you get all the talent that would sustain a family ranch or a family small business. And they say, I'm not going to make money here. So I'm going to go to Wall Street and then perpetuate the problem. Then you wake up 2 generations from now, whether it's farming, oil and gas, nuclear energy, which is prevented by regulations predominantly, but we have a situation here where we're only a couple generations away from literally a competency crisis driven by the fact that nobody knows how to do any of this anymore because they weren't incentivized economically to sustain these practices, whether it's agriculture, energy production, steel production, manufacturing, whatever it may be. We're all incentivized to go in the hyper financialized and hyper growth sectors of finance and tech.
Yeah. When I was in private equity, it was for a small ag fund, and they brought me in strictly because of my boots on the ground knowledge of how the system had to work. We had great analysts, we had great leadership, but those spreadsheets and financial models have to literally apply to boots on the ground. And that was where I came in. That was my background. was, okay, if we're going to operationalize this, this is how we build it. This is how it works. This is how it has to function. Down to even, you know, knowing basic equipment and what you can do. You know, I was a construction manager for quite some time, and those are weird skills that the general public usually doesn't have. And, you know, it's, oh, the well's upside down. Something's wrong. How do you fix it? I'm like, oh, well, there's a lot of different ways you can do that. A lot of it is a lost art because you're not incentivized to do it. Probably the weirdest thing within agriculture is ag kids are known for their work ethic. The construction industry, the hospitality industry love ag kids, and they'll pay them a lot of money to not go back, which is good for them, but it's not great for society on a long-term curve.
Yeah. No, that's what my hope falls back to, just like free market first principles, that it can get very bad. It is getting very bad, but at some point the incentive to like go back, the need for quality food and quality energy infrastructure will get to such a point that the price of actually working those jobs will go up and people will go back. But
sure. Well, have you seen the most recent South Park episode where the handymen are all billionaires? Because it's like for $400, you can't fix a toilet. So they just start charging out the nose. And it's a laugh at the market economy of basically people that can't subsist for themselves. And like at one point, you know, one of the dads is like, kids, I'm going to show you how to fix this thing. And they pick up the phone and call the handyman. That's their version of fixing it. Mm-hmm. Or to those that maybe you're not a South Park fan, you know, Mike Rowe, yep, the guy from Dirty Jobs, anybody that wants to get on YouTube, look up Mike Rowe's address to Congress. He went into Congress. It's a 7-minute video. It's incredible. And he talks about this very thing. Like we're going to miss out on some of this stuff. I don't want to give it away, but it's a great listen.
Yeah. No, you think like energy, ag, civil engineering, like you think of all the urban sprawl that we've built over the last 5 decades and mm-hmm. all the infrastructure maintenance that's needed on all the plumbing and electrical infrastructure that's been built out.
Oh, go look at like some of the, every now and then you'll find pictures when they've like dug up a New York City street mm-hmm. to do a project, and just look at the amount of infrastructure that's under the pavement. It is nuts. Mm-hmm. And people have no idea.
No.
I'm like, well, I flushed the toilet and it's gone. I'm like, it's not magic.
No, it's not.
And some of it's been there for a long time. And one of these days, it may not work anymore.
Yeah. Especially, it'd be part of the reason I got out of New York. I was looking around, it's like the city's falling apart around me. It's, I don't want to be here when the toilets don't flush and the shit starts eking up on the streets.
Well, what'd you think of the steaks, man? Sent you down some steaks.
We had a couple of the New York strips last night. They were incredible. We did a reverse sear in the cast iron. We had some twice baked potatoes and spinach with them. They were delicious.
There you go.
Yeah.
Cool.
We did butter, garlic, thyme, and rosemary.
Very classic.
Yeah.
Appreciate that.
They have a nice, the strips have nice fat caps on them too. Mm-hmm. I love the fat. Very good fat.
Yeah. One of the things that we're able to do within the company, you know, to the quality side, is we age everything for 21 days as a whole carcass. They hang for 21 days, and that's where a lot of that flavor comes from, is that ability to age them as a whole carcass, get that enzymatic breakdown that adds the flavor. I think we had some of the steak yesterday at the event with Jocko and the guys, that like just people are cutting it with a fork.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's the hope.
The 21 days, why 21?
So up to about, you can age up to about 45 days, but it's a decreasing curve. So once you get after about 35 days, you're not going to get a lot of impact. Mm-hmm. But if you have commercial steak, it's harvested, and most of the plant managers in those big commercial plants will tell you that if that animal is still here in any form or factor in 4 days, it's an operational failure. And some of these facilities, like there's two massive harvest plants in Colorado. They're harvesting 6,000 head a day in two shifts. Mm. You know, 16 hours, they're doing 6,000 animals. It's insane. I did the math one time, and like they're unloading a semi-load of cattle every 3.5 minutes.
Holy crap.
Which I've done that, and you can't unload a truck in 3.5 minutes. So it's like 7 or 8 receiving areas. It's crazy. But as you start to age, what you get is you'll have a water shrink in that first like 7 days. Mm-hmm. You have a really good flavor profile change from 7 to 14, and 14 to 21 is just icing on the cake. So if you have any sort of maybe a biological issue, like, because they're all different, right? None of these cattle are cookie cutters. You know, you might have one that has a little more connective tissue or wasn't as finished or something, but that 14 to 21 days is an insurance policy to guarantee the same quality in every box. And it's moderately unimpactful from a cost standpoint. We actually did some research from 14 to 21 days to see how much more water you're losing. And that's one of the things that if you buy a 1 pound steak at the grocery store that wasn't really aged and you cook it down, or you buy a 1 pound steak from us and you cook it down, we're going to have a lot higher yield on a percentage basis because most of the water in ours is gone, mm-hmm. which is where you get that concentration of flavor that you probably noticed yesterday.
Yeah. And they're big steaks too, which was great to see. And the other thing, like defrosting them, the color post defrost was, you couldn't tell that it was frozen.
It looked like it was supposed to.
Yeah. Which is not, I've bought steaks from other ranchers frozen, mm-hmm. vacuum packed and defrosted, and always like, should I cook this? Not always, but sometimes. This, right. I was like, oh, no, this looks good to go.
Yeah, we're very, very particular on the quality control. So Mike, the gentleman we bought the harvest facility from that stayed on to run it, when we were in college, he ran the meat lab at Colorado State University. So, you know, we jokingly, everybody in our company right now is the nerd of some sort. Like Darren over here behind the spotlight, he's the camera nerd. Mm-hmm. I don't know that we've told him that yet, but... I'm the money nerd. My wife is the cow nerd. Mike is the meat nerd. And, you know, when we started down the path of getting the deal done, Mike was like, well, man, what am I supposed to do? I was like, exactly what you're doing now. I don't want to learn that. I don't have time to learn that. You know, let's join forces and make a bigger impact as a group. And he's like, oh, cool. What's really interesting on the cattle fabrication side, you know, you take carcasses and you break them down into steaks. Everybody will look around and, man, how do you do this? How do you do that? How do you change this? And a lot of people in the cattle industry, myself included, my wife and I, when we first started the company, we said, man, I bet it's like 50% cattle quality, like 50% the guy with the knife when it's in a package. Mm-hmm. I think it's about 90-10.
Really?
It's 90% the guy with the knife.
Really?
I mean, good cattle will remain good cattle. But with proper cooler settings, proper cattle handling, proper carcass handling, proper packaging, and an ability to kind of operationalize the quality aspect of it, you can take subpar cattle and make them very good. That is not what we do, but in just watching that, there's a operator near us. They do direct to consumer. They sell only halves. They've done it for decades. They have a waiting list, like, to get on their list. And these guys know cattle. They know how to feed cattle. They're very, very sharp. I've had their meat out of three separate facilities. All three have a different flavor profile.
Interesting.
Strictly based on carcass set or cooler settings, how the carcasses are handled. It's very surprising to me because I was never the meat nerd like Mike is. But yeah, that's one of the things we really push on, is that consistent quality. Every time you open a box, it's going to be the same thing. And then Amy, who's our head of fulfillment at the ranch, I mean, it's okay if this package doesn't look right, if the steak doesn't present right in the package, we don't send it.
Yeah. So do you think you're producing a model that can be replicated? Is that the hopes, is that you're sort mm-hmm. of?
Yeah, there's other people that replicate it already. I mean, you know, Will at White Oak Pastures, they have their own harvest facility on site. Mm-hmm. And then like Joel Salatin at Polyface up in Virginia. There's people doing this. The thing I am hesitant about is just the scale you're asking for. So I did Brad Lee's podcast last fall, the gentleman out of Vegas. Mm. And before I went on this podcast, I did the math. And I was like, oh, man. So, you know, another question for you. How many cattle a day are consumed in New York proper? New York City proper, not the boroughs, just central town.
In Manhattan?
Yeah.
So earlier it was 600,000
a week.
A week slaughter. So that's about, give or take, 90,000 a day. How much is New York consuming per day? 10,000?
6,000.
6,000.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, Joel Salatin is in Virginia, not too far from New York, mm-hmm. but subsequently not too far from Baltimore, not too far from D.C., not too far from Philly. You know, obviously that end of the world is so concentrated with humans. I worry that people like ourselves or Will or Joel or any of those guys, I don't know that it's scalable at the city level. Mm-hmm. Especially when, like, if you get to the Northeast, because there's just not room, right? Like, where I'm from in Eastern Oregon, you know, it's 3 hours to Portland and you're like, oh, I'm going to the next major city. It, say you go north, it's Seattle. It's still 2.5 hours away and there's nothing between it. There's small towns, but it's very spread out. Once you get east of the Mississippi, between towns and big cities, there's not a lot of space.
It's very dense.
Absolutely. So if we look at that from a real estate requirement, from transportation, all the other infrastructure that literally lives in Colorado, Utah, Iowa, Kansas, that produces all this protein and then trucks it into all these population centers, I worry about the scalability on like regional levels, especially when you now throw in climate, you throw in cattle production and then feed especially. So if you look at the cattle market, like Florida is one of the biggest cow-calf states. They have mother cows, because it's beautiful weather, they can do all these things. They don't finish a lot of cattle down there. They move up. They move up towards feed. So if you look at like the cattle market on the commercial side, it's something like 85 or 90% of all finished beef comes out of the cattle feeding triangle, which is Omaha to Denver to Amarillo. It's all right there. So how you move that model or drive commodities a different direction to now have infrastructure to feed those cattle, you know, where are you going to harvest 40,000 head a week just to feed New York in that region? And now copy paste that to every other major metro on the East Coast. That becomes a big math problem.
Is it, would more slaughterhouses and packing facilities solve this, like more distributed?
Maybe. But shipping fat cattle is expensive because you only put about 30 fats on a truck. Mm-hmm. So if you need to haul, I mean, so it's the general resource allocation. It's cheaper to move feed, which doesn't move that often, right? Because for anybody out there that's not up on ag transportation, it's about $6 a loaded mile. So when everybody's like, well, do you feed local? I'm like, as local as you can, because it's expensive to move stuff. Same deal with calves. If you're moving 400 or 500 pound calves, you can put about 100 of them on a truck. If you're moving fat cattle that are ready to go to slaughter, you're putting 30 on a truck. So your per head cost is way higher. So all of it, you know, when you start doing this at scale, doing unitized math, you know, just multiply that across all the different sectors that has to happen. And then if you take a 1300 pound steer and you harvest that steer and you break them into finished product, it's about 450 pounds of meat. Mm-hmm. That's only like 8 cases, like half the size of that table. That's way easier to transport now.
Yeah.
So when you start busting out the logistics of where the cattle have to be, where you're going to move product, how you're going to move product, and then can you feed them? It's a very regional discussion, because once you get east of like central Nebraska, you go further east and you get in that humidity, mm-hmm. cattle don't feed as good. Now, like if you look at some of the feed yards in Iowa, I mean, they've got misters and fans and sunshades. Mm-hmm. That's a whole nother infrastructure cost. Or you go further east into Kentucky or, you know, Virginia, where you might get snow. Or, I mean, it's every one of these things just gets so convoluted. And then if you're in this very concentrated area over on the East Coast and you have a feed yard nearby, somebody's going to be upset. Because they don't smell great.
No. I used to, we used to go to Marquette to play them again in lacrosse when I was in college, and their field was literally right across the street from one of the big four slaughterhouses, mm-hmm. and it was the worst place to play a lacrosse game. It fucking reeked.
Yeah. It's, and I'm not supporting them and saying, well, that's how it has to be, but man, people got to eat.
Yeah.
So I think there's a massive groundswell in the change of the system. I hope that it continues, and we're going to do everything we can to help other people. Like we probably consult with three or four other producers a month. Mm-hmm. Just telling them, this is how we do it. This is who we use for insulators. This is how we buy boxes. I mean, we had one of our major competitors in Colorado email us last week, and they're like, hey, I know we were at that event and you mentioned you switched to UPS. Do you have a contact? No problem. Send it over. Yeah. And I do think we're going to get to a point that it's less centralized, but it's going to take a lot of work.
Yeah.
And it's going to take a lot of capital. I am curious what's going to happen as we continue on in the cycle of business, because a lot of the facilities that Cargill and JBS own are not new. They're going to start aging out at some point. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just thinking about one of the plants in Colorado, Colorado is not exactly friendly to agriculture. The regulatory risk in Colorado is very high. I would be shocked if one of those plants was finally defunct, if they would rebuild in Colorado. That's going to change the whole market. If they move 200 miles east, that changes trucking requirements. It changes off-fall movement. Every one of these things has this ripple effect that, frankly, most of the population is not aware of. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, well, there's just now steak comes from over there. It's like, no, man, that changes everything.
Yeah. Well, going back to like the capital question, that's what I wonder. Do you think there's a case to be made for patient capital in the long run? Like this model proves out, it can be replicable. Like, would it make sense for somebody with a 20, 30 year time horizon from a capital allocation perspective? Like,
maybe.
Yeah.
If you could do it in a region, yeah. My big concern 15 years from now is FedEx and UPS are already overloaded. We ship nationally every Monday and we're growing like crazy and we're not the only one doing that. I don't know how that system's going to hold up. Hmm. And like I said, it's the ripple effect.
Yeah. Dependencies, you know, that 100%. Are external to what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, that's why we purchased a harvest facility. Is because we were speaking for harvest dates 2 years out. Well, how do you forecast growth like we've had 2 years out and be moderately accurate? It's almost impossible. So, okay, we need to control that piece of it. Well, that was a lift. So the more you want to control and be able to actually grow your business, the more systemic you become. And if we look at FedEx and UPS, it's like, oh my goodness. So, okay, now do you try to just be hyper-local? Do we just focus on Denver? That would be ideal. Mm-hmm. I would love to not have to ship product anywhere. But that's up to the market. And the market is, I mean, we had some orders from Texas yesterday because of the event we were at. Mm-hmm. It's no factor. We can do that. But if we look at that and say, okay, how do we feed these people with the existing infrastructure? It's a challenge.
God, we got a lot of problems to solve.
I do think, though, I'm very hopeful.
I'm as well.
There was a gentleman, I can't remember his name, is a logging advocate out of Libby, Montana, has a civil engineering degree. He spoke at an event I was at last year, and his message was awesome. Really loved listening to the guy, but in general, he said, hey, guys, it looks like we have problems, and we do, but let's rewind a little bit. Revolutionary War. War of 1812, American Civil War, Spanish-American War, Spanish Flu, World War I, World War II, Great Depression, Civil Rights Movement, Korea, Vietnam. He goes, it's actually a lot better than you think right now. Mm-hmm. He goes, I'm not saying there's not things to look at, but, you know, there's times it's been worse. And I think the way he described it, and if I'm butchering it, my apologies, his comment was, he goes, the reason it feels so bad is nobody wants to hold on to hope. Mm-hmm. And he's like, it's not to say there's not work to do, but it looks bad when you're sitting in a spot and you're looking up the mountain. But if you turn 180 degrees and look how far you've come, it gives a different level of perspective. I just really loved that message.
Yeah. You gotta have hope. Yeah. Read from Shawshank Redemption.
You know? There you go.
Hope is a good thing. Maybe it's the best thing. You gotta have hope. And that's, again, like, we have come so far, and again, I'm going to hammer it home.
buy Bitcoin, right?
Buy Bitcoin, okay. But I think the more importantly, like, why buy Bitcoin? It's because the money's broken and it's created all this hopelessness out there. Again, going back to, like, people are working. They're like, what the fuck? Like, I can't even afford to buy a steak. I can't afford
my rent,
my electricity bill, my grocery bill. And at least for millennials, like, I know a lot of people are like, why the fuck am I even working? And then you see what the government's doing, printing all this debt and issuing all this debt. The central bank's printing money, and then they're taking all this debt and putting it in places where it probably shouldn't be.
Yeah.
And it's not producing a return for your average American. You can understand why people are extremely pissed off, but I agree. Like, you should have hope, but you're proving it. Or models to get away from this. Like, Bitcoin gives you agency from a monetary perspective to say, hey, I'm removing myself from the system and operating in this monetary system detached from the government and the central banks that they cannot perturb or centrally control. And I completely agree. We've never lived during a time when you have more opportunity to actually build your way out of this. That's the hope with this show and the conversations that we have and what we do with our website and the newsletters, like, to prove to people, like, hey, like, you're not going to vote your way out of this problem. And getting your way out of this problem is not going to be easy, but you do have the agency and the ability to build your way out of this problem with new business models, with new monetary systems, whatever it may be, the access to open source software, to unique capital structures has never been what it is today. And if you have the agency and the drive to actually build your way out of this, you can, it's easier than ever to do that.
Yeah, there's never been a more opportunity ridden time in society, in my opinion, but the guardrails are more than they've ever been. So you just got to get on your running shoes and maybe climb a little bit.
Yeah. And tell the government to leave us alone.
Just live where I do, man. It's great. Everybody, not to make light of COVID, but I had some people like, man, how's social distancing going? I'm like, we were doing that before. We don't have anybody that's not family within like 3 miles. It's not so bad.
No.
So.
No, that's actually one of my, another silver lining of the day and age we live in. It seems like states are beginning to assert their autonomy from the federal government in a big way post-COVID. Which is good, in keeping the federal government in check to stop it from overreaching and making things too burdensome is very important. The states are beginning to be like, hey, you guys are fucking things up too much.
Yeah, like, dude, if I had a magic wand, term limits would be 10 days ago. Like, that grossness that is lifelong politicians, just that's out of any of it, the thing that I'm like, it does not resonate with me. Like, we're supposed to have citizen legislators, not legislator politicians for a career.
Yeah. Like, I saw a meme on Twitter yesterday. Chuck Schumer graduated law school in 1975 and became a senator in 1976. Has been.
So what have you done?
Like, yeah.
Yeah. You've just been part of the machine.
Yeah. It's been 50 years and it's, I'm hopeful we'll get away from it.
Absolutely. Well, hey man, I appreciate it. Thank you very much for having me.
I appreciate you, Jeff. Thank you for coming. I'm pumped. Shout out to Harry and Brett from the Meat Mafia podcast for linking us up last week. Those guys are awesome.
Yeah, they're solid dudes.
Yeah, really cool things going on here in Austin, whether it's the health scene, the Bitcoin scene, the tech scene. It's cool. I'm happy that you were able to get down here and check it out.
Well, appreciate it, man. And sure, we'll have some links in the show notes, right?
Definitely. We'll link to everything in the show
notes. I'll have Darren send you all the particular stuff. They don't let me communicate on the marketing side. So.
Well, safe travels back to Colorado. It was a pleasure to meet you and keep crushing it, dude.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Peace and love, freaks. Tiki!